St. Thomas Aquinas. Dash. Book 3. Chapter I. Foreword. The Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods, for the Lord will not reject his people, for in his hands are all the ends of the earth and the heights of the mountains are his, for the sea is his and he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. We have shown in the preceding books that there is one first being, possessing the full perfection of all being, whom we call God, and who of the abundance of his perfection, bestows being on all that exists, so that he is proved to be not only the first of beings, but also the beginning of all. Moreover, he bestows being on others, not through natural necessity, but according to the decree of his will, as we have shown above. Hence it follows that he is a lord of the things made by him, since we dominate over those things that are subject to our will. And this is a perfect dominion that he exercises over things made by him, forasmuch as in their making he needs neither the help of an extrinsic agent, nor matter as the foundation of his work, since he is the universal efficient cause of all being. Now everything that is produced through the will of an agent is directed to an end by that agent, because the good and the end are the proper object of the will. Wherefore whatever proceeds from a will must needs be directed to an end, and each thing attains its end by its own action, which action needs to be directed by him who endowed things with the principles whereby they act. Consequently God, who in himself is perfect in every way, and by his power endows all things with being, must needs be the ruler of all, himself ruled by none, nor is anything to be accepted from his ruling, as neither is there anything that does not owe its being to him. Therefore as he is perfect in being and causing, so is he perfect in ruling. The effect of this ruling is seen to differ in different things, according to the difference of natures. For some things are so produced by God that, being intelligent, they bear a resemblance to him and reflect his image, wherefore not only are they directed, but they direct themselves to their appointed end by their own actions. And if in thus directing themselves they be subject to the divine ruling, they are admitted by that divine ruling to the attainment of their last end, but are excluded therefrom if they direct themselves otherwise. Others there are, bereft of intelligence, which do not direct themselves to their end, but are directed by another. Of these some being incorruptible, even as they are not patient of defect in their natural being, so neither do they wander, in their own action, from the direction to their appointed end, but are subject, without fail, to the ruling of the Supreme Ruler. Such are the heavenly bodies, whose movements are invariable. Others, however, being corruptible, are patient of defects in their natural being, yet this defect is supplied to the advantage of another, since when one thing is corrupted, another is generated. Likewise, they fail from their natural direction in their own actions, yet this failing is compensated by some resultant good. Whence it is clear that not even those things which are seen to wander from the direction of the Supreme Ruling, escape from the power of the Supreme Ruler, because also these corruptible bodies, even as they are created by God, so too are they perfectly subject to him. Wherefore, considering this, the psalmist, filled with the divine spirit, in order to give us an illustration of the divine government, first describes to us the perfection of the Supreme Governor, as to his nature when he says, God, as to his power, when he says, a great Lord, implying that he needs no one for his power to produce its effect, as to his authority, when he says, a great King above all gods, since, although there be many rulers, yet are all subject to his rule. Secondly, he describes to us the manner of this government, as regards intellectual beings, which, if they submit to his rule, receive from him their last end, which is himself, wherefore he says, for the Lord will not reject his people. As regards things corruptible, which, albeit at times they wander from their proper mode of action, never escape the power of the Supreme Ruler, he says, because in his hands are all the ends of the earth. And as regards the heavenly bodies, which transcend the highest summits of the earth, that is of corruptible bodies, and always maintain the order of the divine government, he says, and the mountain heights are his. Thirdly, he assigns the reason of this universal government, For the things that God made must needs be governed by him. To this he refers when he says, "For the sea is his," etc. Since then in the first book we have treated of the perfection of the divine nature, and, in the second, of the perfection of the divine power, inasmuch as he is the creator and lord of all, it remains for us in this third book to treat of his perfect authority or dignity, inasmuch as he is the end and governor of all. We must therefore proceed in this wise, so as first to treat of him as the end of all things, secondly of his universal government, inasmuch as he governs every creature, thirdly, of that special government, whereby he governs creatures endowed with intelligence. Chapter 2. That every agent acts for an end. Accordingly, we must first show that every agent, by its action, intends an end, for in those things which clearly act for an end, we declare the end to be the towards which the movement of the agent tends, for when this is reached, the end is said to be reached, and to fail in this is to fail in the end intended, as may be seen in the physician who aims at health, and in a man who runs towards an appointed goal. Nor does it matter, as to this, whether that which tends to an end be cognitive or not, for just as the target is the end of the archer, so is it the end of the arrow's flight. Now the movement of every agent tends to something determinate, since it is not from any force that any action proceeds, but heating proceeds from heat, and cooling from cold, wherefore actions are differentiated by their active principles. Action sometimes terminates in something made, for instance building terminates in a house, healing ends in health, while sometimes it does not so terminate, for instance, understanding and sensation. And if action terminate in something made, the movement of the agent tends by that action towards that thing made, while if it does not terminate in something made, the movement of the agent tends to the action itself. It follows therefore that every agent intends an end while acting, which end is sometimes the action itself, sometimes a thing made by the action. Again, in all things that act for an end, that is said to be the last end, beyond which the agent seeks nothing further. Thus the physician's action goes as far as health, and this being attained, his efforts cease. But in the action of every agent, a point can be reached beyond which the agent does not desire to go, else actions would tend to infinity, which is impossible, for since it is not possible to pass through an infinite medium, the agent would never begin to act, because nothing moves towards what it cannot reach. Therefore every agent acts for an end. Moreover, if the actions of an agent proceed to infinity, these actions must needs result either in something made, or not. If the result is something made, the being of that thing made will follow after an infinity of actions. But that which presupposes an infinity of things, cannot possibly be, since an infinite medium cannot be passed through. Now impossibility of being argues impossibility of becoming, and that which cannot become, it is impossible to make. Therefore it is impossible for an agent to begin to make a thing for the making of which an infinity of actions are presupposed. If, however, the result of such actions be not something made, the order of these actions must be either according to the order of active forces, for instance if a man feel that he may imagine, and imagine that he may understand, and understand that he may will, or according to the order of objects, for instance I consider the body that I may consider the soul, which I consider in order to consider a separate substance, which again I consider so that I may consider God. Now it is not possible to proceed to infinity, either in active forces, as neither is this possible in the forms of things, as proved in 2 Metaphysics. Since the form is the principle of activity, or in objects, as neither is this possible in beings, since there is one first being, as we have proved above. Therefore it is not possible for agents to proceed to infinity, and consequently there must be something, which being attained, the efforts of the agent cease. Therefore every agent acts for an end. Further, in things that act for an end, whatsoever comes between the first agent and the last end, is an end in respect to what precedes, and an active principle in respect of what follows. Hence if the effort of the agent does not tend to something determinate, and if its action, as stated, proceeds to infinity, The active principles must needs proceed to infinity, which is impossible, as we have shown above. Therefore the effort of the agent must of necessity tend to something determinate. Again, every agent acts either by nature or by intelligence. Now there can be no doubt that those which act by intelligence act for an end, since they act with an intellectual preconception of what they attain by their action, and act through such preconception, for this is to act by intelligence. Now just as in the preconceiving intellect there exists the entire likeness of the effect that is attained by the action of the intellectual being, so in the natural agent there pre-exists the similitude of the natural effect, by virtue of which similitude its action is determined to the appointed effect, for fire begets fire, and an olive produces an olive. Wherefore even as that which acts by intelligence tends by its action to a definite end, so also does that which acts by nature. Therefore every agent acts for an end. Moreover, fault is not found save in those things which are for an end, for we do not find fault with one who fails in that to which he is not appointed. Thus we find fault with a physician if he failed to heal, but not with a builder or a grammarian. But we find fault in things done according to art, as when a grammarian fails to speak correctly, and in things that are ruled by nature, as in the case of monstrosities. Therefore every agent, whether according to nature, or according to art, or acting of set purpose, acts for an end. Again, were an agent not to act for a definite effect, all effects would be indifferent to it. Now that which is indifferent to many effects does not produce one rather than another. Wherefore from that which is indifferent to either of two effects, no effect results, unless it be determined by something to one of them. Hence it would be impossible for it to act. Therefore every agent tends to some definite effect, which is called its end. There are, however, certain actions which would seem not to be for an end, such as playful and contemplative actions, and those which are done without attention, such as scratching one's beard, and the like, whence some might be led to think that there is an agent that acts not for an end. But we must observe that contemplative actions are not for another end, but are themselves an end. Playful actions are sometimes an end, when one plays for the mere pleasure of play, and sometimes they are for an end, as when we play that afterwards we may study better. Actions done without attention do not proceed from the intellect, but from some sudden act of the imagination, or some natural principle. Thus a disordered humor produces an itching sensation and is the cause of a man scratching his beard, which he does without his mind attending to it. Such actions do tend to an end, although outside the order of the intellect. Hereby is excluded the error of certain natural philosophers of old, who maintain that all things happen by natural necessity, thus utterly banishing the final cause from things. Chapter 3. That every agent acts for a good. Hence we must go on to prove that every agent acts for a good. For that every agent acts for an end clearly follows from the fact that every agent tends to something definite. Now that to which an agent tends definitely must needs be befitting to that agent, since the latter would not tend to it save on account of some fittingness thereto. But that which is befitting to a thing is good for it. Therefore every agent acts for a good. Further, the end is that wherein the appetite of the agent or mover is at rest, as also the appetite of that which is moved. Now it is the very notion of good to be the term of appetite, since good is the object of every appetite. Therefore all action and movement is for a good. Again, all action and movement would seem to be directed in some way to being, either for the preservation of being in the species or in the individual, or for the acquisition of being. Now this itself, being to wit, is a good, and for this reason all things desire being. Therefore all action and movement is for a good. Furthermore, all action and movement is for some perfection. For if the action itself be the end, it is clearly a second perfection of the agent. And if the action consist in the transformation of external matter, clearly the mover intends to induce some perfection into the thing moved, towards which perfection the movable tends, if the movement be natural. Now when we say a thing is perfect, We mean that it is good, therefore every action and movement is for a good. Also, every agent acts according as it is actual. Now by acting it tends to something similar to itself, therefore it tends to an act. But an act has the ratio of good, since evil is not found save in a potentiality lacking act, therefore every action is for a good. Moreover, the intellectual agent acts for an end, as determining on its end, whereas the natural agent, though it acts for an end, as proved above, does this not determine on its end, since it knows not the ratio of end, but is moved to the end determined for it by another. Now an intellectual agent does not determine the end for itself except under the aspect of good, for the intelligible object does not move except it be considered as a good, which is the object of the will. Therefore also the natural agent is not moved, nor does it act for an end, except in so far as this end is a good, since the end is determined for the natural agent by an appetite. Therefore every agent acts for a good. Again, to shun evil and to seek good are in the same ratio, even as movement from below and upward movement are in the same ratio. Now we observe that all things shun evil, for intellectual agents shun a thing for the reason that they apprehend it as an evil, and all natural agents, in proportion to their strength, resist corruption, which is the evil of everything. Therefore all things act for a good. Again, that which results from the agent's action beside his intention, is said to happen by chance or luck. Now we observe in the works of nature that either always or more often that happens which is best. Thus in plants the leaves are so placed as to protect the fruit, and the parts of an animal are so disposed as to conduce to the animal's safety. Wherefore, if this happens beside the intention of the natural agent, it will be the result of chance or luck. But that is impossible, because things that happen always or frequently are not casual or fortuitous, but those which occur seldom. Therefore the natural agent tends to that which is best, and much more evidently is this so with the intellectual agent. Therefore every agent intends a good in acting. Moreover, whatever is moved is brought to the term of movement by the mover and agent. Therefore mover and moved tend to the same term. Now that which is moved, since it is in potentiality, tends to an act, and consequently to perfection and goodness, for by its movement it passes from potentiality to act. Therefore mover and agent by moving and acting always intend a good. Hence the philosophers in defining the good said the good is the object of every appetite, and Dionysius says that all things desire the good and the best. Chapter 4. That evil is unintentional in things. It follows from the above that evil is incidental to things beside the intention of an agent. For when the result of an action differs from the intention of the agent, it is clear that such result occurs unintentionally. Now evil differs from good, which every agent intends. Therefore evil happens beside the intention. Also, defect in effect and action results from defect in the principle of action. Thus a monstrosity results from a defect in the seed, and limping results from a curvature of the leg. Now an agent acts according as it is possessed of active force, and not according as it suffers from defective power. And according as it acts, it intends the end. Wherefore it intends an end corresponding to its power. Hence whatever follows corresponding to the defective power will be beside the agent's intention, and this is evil. Therefore evil occurs beside the intention. Again, the movement of the thing moved has the same tendency as the motion of the mover. Now the thing moved tends per se to good, but to evil it tends accidentally and unintentionally. This is most evident in generation and corruption. For matter, while it underlies one form, is in potentiality to another form, and to the privation of the form which it has already. Thus when it is under the form of air, it is in potentiality to the form of fire and the privation of the form of air. And the transformation of matter terminates in both at the same time in the form of fire by reason of fire being generated, and in the privation of the form of air, by reason of the air being corrupted. But the intention and appetite of matter is not towards the privation, but towards the form, for it does not tend towards the impossible, and it is impossible for matter to be alone under a privation, whereas it is possible for it to be under a form. Therefore it is unintentional that it terminate in privation, and it terminates therein insofar as it attains the form which it intends, the necessary result whereof is the privation of the other form. Therefore in generation and corruption the transformation of matter is directed per se to the form, and privation results unintentionally. And the same must needs apply to all manner of movement, so that in every movement there is generation and corruption in some respect. For instance, when a thing is changed from white to black, a white thing is corrupted and a black one is made. Now the good is according as matter is perfected by the form, and potentiality by its proper act, while evil is according as it is deprived of its proper act. Consequently, whatever is moved intends in its movement to attain some good, and it attains evil beside its intention. Hence, since every agent and mover tends to the good, evil occurs beside the intention of the agent. Moreover, in those things that act by intelligence or any kind of instinct, intention follows apprehension, because the intention is towards that which is apprehended as an end. Accordingly, if something is attained that has no species in the apprehension, it will be beside the intention. For instance, if one were to intend to eat honey, and were to eat gall thinking that it was honey, this will be beside the intention. But every intellectual agent tends to something in so far as he considers it under the aspect of good, as we have shown above. If this be not a good but an evil, it will be beside the intention. Therefore that which acts by intelligence does not work evil except unintentionally. Therefore, since to tend to a good is common to intellectual and natural agents, evil does not ensue from the intention of an agent except beside that intention. In this sense Dionysius says that evil is unintentional and involuntary. Chapters 5 and 6. Arguments that would seem to prove that evil is not beside the intention. There are, however, some objections that would seem to run counter to this conclusion. For that which occurs beside the intention of the agent is said to happen fortuitously, casually and seldom. But evil is not said to happen fortuitously and casually, nor does it occur seldom but always or frequently. For in the physical order generation is ever accompanied by corruption, and involuntary agents sin is of frequent occurrence, since it is as difficult to behave virtuously as to find the center of a circle, as Aristotle states. Therefore it would seem that evil is not an unintentional occurrence. Again, Aristotle says expressly that vice is voluntary, and he proves this from the fact that a man does an injustice voluntarily, and it is absurd to suppose that the man who does unjust actions voluntarily does not wish to be unjust, and that he who rapes voluntarily does not wish to be incontinent. And again from the fact that legislators punish evildoers as doing evil voluntarily. Therefore evil would seem not to be unintentional or involuntary. Further, every natural movement has an end intended by nature. Now corruption is a natural movement, even as generation. Therefore its end, which is privation having the aspect of evil, is intended by nature, even as the form and the good, which are the end of generation. In order that the solution of the arguments here give may be made clear, we must observe that evil may be considered either as in a substance, or as in its action. In a substance that is evil through its lacking something natural and due to it, for that a man have not wings, is not an evil to him, because it is not natural for him to have them. And again, if a man have not fair hair, this is no evil, for although he may have it naturally, it is not due to him. But it is an evil if he have no hands, which are natural and due to him, if he be perfect, and yet it is not an evil to a bird. Now every privation, if we take it properly and strictly, is the lack of something natural and due, and consequently the aspect of evil is always in a privation thus understood. Matter, since it is in potentiality to all forms, is adapted by nature to all of them. Yet no one is due to it, since it can be actually perfect without any particular one. Nevertheless, some one of them is due to one of those things that are made of matter, for there can be no water without the form of water, nor can there be fire without the form of fire. Accordingly, the privation of such a form, in relation to matter, is not an evil to matter, but in relation to that thing of which it is the form, it is an evil thereof. Thus the privation of the form of fire is an evil of fire, and since privations as well as habits and forms are not set to exist except for as much as they are in a subject, if privation be an evil in relation to the subject wherein it is, it will be an evil simply, otherwise it will be the evil of something but not simply. Hence that a man be deprived of a hand is an evil simply, but that matter be deprived of the form of air is not an evil simply, but an evil of the air. On the other hand, privation of order or due proportion in an action is an evil of the action. And since to every action order and proportion are due, such a privation in an action must needs be an evil simply. Accordingly, taking these remarks into account, we must note that what is unintentional is not always fortuitous or casual, as the first argument stated. For if that which is unintentional be always or frequently the result of that which was intended, it will not happen fortuitously or casually. Thus, if a man intends to enjoy the sweetness of wine, and becomes drunk through drinking, this will be neither fortuitous nor casual, but it would be casual if such a result were to occur seldom. Therefore the evil of natural corruption, although it ensue beside the intention of the generator, follows nevertheless always, since the presence of one form is ever accompanied by the privation of another. Wherefore corruption does not ensue casually, nor even seldom, although sometimes privation is not an evil simply, but the evil of some particular thing, as stated above. If, however, the privation be such as to deprive the thing generated of that which is due to it, it will be casual and an evil simply, as in the birth of monstrosities, for this does not follow of necessity from that which was intended, but is opposed thereto, since the agent intends the perfection of the thing generated. Evil of action occurs in natural agents through a defect in the active force. Hence, if the agent's force be defective, this evil ensues beside the intention, yet it will not be casual, because it follows of necessity from such an agent, provided always that the agent in question always or frequently suffer this defect. But it will be casual if this defect seldom accompanies this agent. In voluntary agents, the intention is directed to some particular good. If the action is to follow, for movement is not caused by universals but by particulars about which actions are. Accordingly, if the good that is intended is accompanied always or frequently by the privation of a rational good, moral evil ensues not casually, but either always or frequently, as in the case of a man who desires intercourse with the woman for the sake of pleasure, to which pleasure is connected the inordination of adultery. Wherefore the evil of adultery is not a casual sequel. It would, however, be a casual evil, if sin were to ensue seldom from what he intends, as in one who, while firing at a bird, kills a man. That anyone should intend such like goods which frequently result in privation of a rational good, is due to the fact that many live a sensuous life, because sensible things are the more manifest to us, and move more efficaciously in a world of individual things among which operation takes place, and privation of the rational good ensues from many goods of that kind. Hence it follows that, although evil is beside the intention, it is nevertheless voluntary, as the second argument states, accidentally however and not per se. For intention is directed to the last end, which we will for its own sake, while the will is directed also to that which we will for the sake of something else, even though we would not will it simply. For instance, the man who throws his cargo overboard for the sake of safety, intends not the throwing of his cargo, but safety, and he wills the throwing of the cargo, not simply but for the sake of safety. In like manner, for the sake of obtaining a sensible good, a man wills to perform an inordinate action, neither intending the inordinateness nor willing it simply, but for the sake of something in particular. In the same way, therefore, sin and vice are said to be voluntary, as the throwing of a ship's cargo into the sea. The third objection is solved on the same lines. For the change of corruption is never found without the change of generation, and consequently neither is the end of corruption found without the end of generation. Hence nature does not intend the end of corruption apart from the end of generation, but both at the same time. For it is not the absolute intention of nature that there be no water, but that there be air, the existence of which precludes the existence of air. Accordingly, nature intends directly that there should be air, but it does not intend that there should not be water except in so far as this is involved by the existence of air. Wherefore, privations are not intended by nature directly, but accidentally, whereas forms are intended directly. From the foregoing, it is clear that what is evil simply is utterly beside the intention in the operations of nature, for example the birth of monstrosities, but what is evil not simply but relatively, is intended by nature, not directly but accidentally. Chapter 7. That evil is not an essence. From this it follows that no essence is evil in itself, for evil, as we have said, is nothing else but the privation of what is connatural and due to anyone, for the word evil is used in this sense by all. Now privation is not an essence, but is the non-existence of something in a substance. Therefore evil is not a real essence. Again, a thing has being in respect of its essence. Now in so far as it has being, it has a share of good, for if good is what all desire, being itself must be called a good, since all things desire being. Therefore a thing is good in so far as it has an essence. But good and evil are opposed to each other. Therefore nothing is evil in so far as it has an essence. Therefore no essence is evil. Moreover, everything is either an agent or something made. But evil cannot be an agent, for that which acts, acts inasmuch as it is actually existing and perfect. In like manner neither can it be something made, since the term of every generation is a form and a good. Therefore nothing is evil as to its essence. Again, nothing tends to its contrary, for everything desires what is like and becoming to it. Now everything by acting intends a good, as we proved above. Therefore no being as such is evil. Further, every essence is natural to something, for if it be in the genus of substance, it is the very nature of that thing, and if it be in the genus of accident, it must needs flow from the principles of some substance, and thus will be natural to that substance, although perchance it may not be natural to some other substance. Thus heat is natural to fire, whereas it is not natural to water. Now that which is evil in itself cannot be natural to a thing, for it belongs to the very nature of evil to be the privation of that which is connatural and due to a thing. Therefore evil, since it is the privation of what is natural, cannot be natural to a thing. Hence whatever is in a thing naturally is good for that thing, and it is an evil if it be lacking. Therefore no essence is evil in itself. Moreover, whatever has an essence is either itself a form, or has a form, since it is by the form that each thing is placed in a genus or species. Now a form, as such, has the ratio of goodness, for it is the principle of action, and the end which every maker intends, and is the act whereby whatever has a form is perfect. Therefore whatever has an essence, as such, is good. Therefore evil has not an essence. Further, being is divided into act and potentiality. Now act, as such, is a good, because, in so far as a thing is in act, it is perfect. Again potentiality is a good, for potentiality tends to act, as clearly may be seen in every kind of movement. Also, it is proportionate to act, and not contrary thereto. Moreover it is in the same genus as act. Also privation does not apply to it save accidentally. Therefore everything that is, in whatever way it is, in so far as it is a being, is a good. Therefore evil has not an essence. Again, it has been proved in the second book of this work, that every being, in whatever way it is from God, and we have shown in the first book, that God is perfect goodness. Since, then, evil cannot be the effect of good, it is impossible for a being, as such, to be evil. Hence it is that it is said God saw all the things that he had made, and they were very good, and he hath made all things good in their time, and every creature of God is good. Again Dionysius says that evil is not a thing that exists, per se, to wit, nor is it something in things that exist, as an accident, like whiteness or blackness. Hereby is refuted the error of the Manichees, who held that there are certain things evil by their very nature. Dash.